Yeah, it was really interesting. So for the last, I can't work out if it was a few days or a few weeks, but I basically felt increasingly horrendous to the point where I thought I was going mad. I just couldn't find peace. I kind of was resisting the prompts of the Holy Spirit, but I kind of was ignoring that I was resisting them. So it was just this awful position to be in. And eventually, I think it was Friday, last Friday, I'd been processing it a bit with people, with Chris and so on, but I basically said, look, I've got to hear from God. I just cannot go on like this. What is wrong? Why am I struggling? And so on. And he had a very interesting picture, which kind of fits with what we're talking about today, and speaks into why rebuke is a real relief when you're in pain, which was a vine. And one of the words that we had read over our wedding, and what I've always wanted to be and see myself in, is remain in me and I will remain in you. And if you remain in me, you'll bear much fruit. And if you won't, you'll be cut off and burnt. Because he's into fruit, like any good gardener. And my desire of my life is to remain in him and be fruitful. So it was very pertinent. Chris had this picture of a branch that looked strong on the outside but was hollow in the inside, and I just knew as soon as he said it, Jesus was saying to me is you've lost your connectedness with me, the intimacy with me, that closeness to the Holy Spirit. And it was like I knew that I'd been ignoring, I'd been resisting him, but suddenly I was like, oh yeah, I've been resisting you know. I could, it almost, his rebuke liberated me into reconnection and intimacy. And it was a complete relief. It was like going to the doctor, knowing there was something wrong with you, not knowing what it was, and the doctor just says, this is what's wrong, and this is how we're going to deal with it. It was just brilliant. And the reason this feeds into what we're doing today is I put a picture of a sandwich there. Because I think there is like a sandwich of the churches. The first and the third are wealthy cities, Sardis and Laodicea, and by all means, probably, therefore, the churches are pretty, look flourishing. One of them certainly has a reputation. We know many churches that have a very good reputation, don't we? People think it's great and it's all going well. Laodicea was a flourishing, I just mentioned it. It's strongly famous for medical, but particularly eyes and finances and textiles. And the middle church, Philadelphia, was so weak that he was just saying, I will strengthen you and help you get through. That actually, if we were humanly looking at those three churches, we would probably think the Sardis one and the Laodicea were doing really well. You know, they're flourishing, they're strong, they're rich, they're in rich cities, they're strategic. But the Philadelphia one, we'd be like, gosh, it's really struggling. It's just about getting through. But what I kind of felt from anyway about this talk and from my journey was actually what we think God sees when he looks at a group of believers, and what he actually sees is very, very different. In fact, it's the opposite. The rebukes and the strong correction come with Sardis and Laodicea because they think they've got somewhere. They may even have got somewhere in the past, but we look a bit, I've got my laurel wreath here, they're resting on their laurels, they've become complacent, they are now actually poor, as he says to Laodicea, blind, wretched, naked, pitiful. They just don't know. They're not actually, maybe to use my analogy, reconnected in or in that place of intimacy. However, the Philadelphia church is the one who, if you imagine the context, there would have been a thriving, strong religious community, of which, because they were confessing that Yeshua was Messiah, they were, would not have been a part of that, would have been heavily persecuted and really struggling to keep faith. They didn't have an established central community or religious way of doing things at all. They were very new believers in Yeshua. And so they would have been under heavy persecution. And God sees those three churches completely the opposite to how it feels they see themselves, or other people even see them. So it says, you have a reputation, which means other churches would have gone, oh, that church in Sardis, they're doing really well. And he's like, you're actually dead. You know, you're just about to die. Strengthen that little bit. Everyone thinks you're great. I can see through. So with me, he was basically saying, you may look like you're a vine that's fruitful and effective on the outside, but inside, you've broken connection with me. You're not in intimacy. Now, I think, by the grace of God, that was a seasonal thing. That's not a general truth about me. And now I've recovered intimacy. But it was such a relief to be just told the truth. It really did set me free. So I think the enemy tries to energize a resistance or a distrust of rebuke. Again, because he maligns the character of God and the ways of God. But actually, if we understand how good and kind God is and how he's passionately pursuing us and pursuing intimacy and connectedness, suddenly we run to that word that sets us free, that word of truth, even if it's a tough word.
I thought of an analogy.
Yeah.
Anyone likes those period costume things. Is it
Emma in Jane Austen's book? She's rebuked by
Mr. Knightley.
That's it, Mr. Knightley. And it's because he loves her that he rebukes her, because he can see that she's hurting some of her friends.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's an example.
Yeah. Well, that is an example exactly of calling someone to who they really are, calling them to step up and be the person they're designed to be. And in my case, to be connected deeply with him, to be fruitful and effective, and in that brilliant fictional example, to be someone who's kind to their friends, exactly that. Now, I'm just going to switch tack a bit. A friend of mine who lives locally posted this, I thought it was a really beautiful post on Facebook. It must have been the 1st of December, yeah. As our children open their Advent calendars, the news shows us photos of children in Aleppo opening body bags. I can't imagine the horror of the people of Aleppo face as they continue their descent into hell, to quote the UN spokesperson. I simply know that I'm very, very lucky. These words from the carol, "It Came Upon a Midnight Clear," have been ringing in my head all week. And man at war with man hears not the love song which they bring. Oh, hush the noise, ye men of strife, and hear the angels sing. Which it was a very beautiful thing for someone to post. But I was interested in the word luck. So I think, and I understand why people would use the word luck, that I happen to be born in the country I'm born in. I get that. I wouldn't use the word luck, but I get that. But it isn't luck that this country has inherited a way of dealing with things internally which is not violent, and other countries do. Now, we have used, don't get me wrong, we have used violence abroad, and we do at the moment, and we also historically have been incredibly cruel, like we invented the concentration camps in 100 years ago and bought the Boer War. But at some level, we've made decisions when it comes to leading, how we lead and how we govern, where we've made the decision to follow Christ's teaching, to do it peacefully. So you love your enemies in that, and you see that politically, you honour, respect, you know, you vote, you resign if you're not voted in, and so on. What I think the message of Revelation is for us today, my message to myself and a message to this nation, is we cannot rest on the laurels of that generational inheritance. We cannot rest on the laurels. Our luck will run out. And in a few generations' time, if we don't contend for Jesus' way of doing things, which is that carol, she points to that beautiful carol, and man at war with man hears not the love song which they bring. Oh, hush the noise, you men of strife, and hear the angels sing. Her point was, this is the time where we were celebrating someone who came into the earth to bring peace. And as a nation, some people, many people haven't, but some people have taken him at his word and sought peace. And as a result, that little bit of yeast has been rubbed through the whole dough of the way we do politics and the way we run things so that we don't use violence to achieve leadership of this country. However, if we don't continue to walk in that, who's to say in 2, 3, 4, 5 generations that actually that will be how we do it? And I think that was the issue with these churches, with Sardis and Laodicea. They may have had, I mean, they obviously have this reputation from somewhere. They've had things in their spiritual history with God that they're renowned for. They're in contexts where they're seen as successful. And yet, the grace runs out if we don't keep contending for it. And one of my big phrases in my life is, if we're not actively taking territory, we're losing it. There isn't a moral ground or a neutral ground. There isn't a, I can just coast. Because the enemy is out there to rob, kill and destroy. We don't need to worry about it. We don't need to fear it. We just need to acknowledge that is the nature of a predatory enemy in any situation. We have this authority to continue to contend for righteousness and peace and justice. And if we are... if we rest on the laurels of decisions generations back have made and we come into that inherited blessing, it is a blessing. I would say blessing. Some people say luck, we're born into it. But it isn't blessing or luck whether we continue. It continues for our children. It is my choice now, in my 30s, in my 40s, as someone who has a voice in this nation, to continue to contend for those ways. Does that make sense? And then we have beautiful, beautiful Philadelphia church. And I read a lovely little story, a man called Pastor Edward, who is a pastor in Aleppo at the moment in Syria. And I imagine, you know, it's a very painful church, very painful situation, lots of suffering and death. And it reminded me of this, the church in Philadelphia, but there's no rebuke there, is there? Because they are fighting for what they know is right. They're fighting for peace, they're fighting for grace, they're fighting for forgiveness. And he will open a door for them that no one can shut. He will give them authority. So there may be churches around the world that have great reputations, but actually we're not, you know, when things are exposed and brought into the light, what will really be there to show? And then there are other churches where we go, gosh, that's probably really tough and not very, very, doesn't feel very powerful or strong. It's actually the ones that he's saying, you're the ones that are alive. You will pass through the trial. You will be protected. So this, it's a real encouragement, I feel, for us as people, whether we were maybe born into a Christian family, certainly some of us are born into a nation that has at least historically called itself Christian, to not rest on our laurels. I've got this picture here, as you can see, of a laurel wreath. And I'm referring back to last week that we did, we're designed to overcome. And we were overcome, and people historically, theologians, have put it into three categories: the world, the flesh and the devil. And a lot of that is put in those first four letters. You see different aspects where different things are contending for how we live, our hearts, and we are designed to be victorious over these things, over the world, over the temptations to our flesh and over the enemy. And I think this week, although those are still pertinent in these three letters, what I really feel is the biggest temptation of all is to stop contending when you've had the victory, is to rest, this very famous phrase, rest on your laurels. So the laurel wreath, we have that word in poet laureate now, was in the ancient Greeks, was given to victors, both in athletic competitions and in poetic meets. In ancient Rome, were symbols of martial victory, so symbols of war. And resting on one laurels is saying, that happened to me, I'm just going to sit down now and coast. It will be all right because I've had my victory. And you can see there's a whole thread of scriptures of famous men and women who have had incredible victories, and they're most vulnerable straight after that moment. So we think we're vulnerable in that initial overcoming, but I think these letters show us it's actually we're almost more vulnerable when we've overcome. So we see with Noah, he had this incredible journey of seeing breakthrough after the flood. He plants a vineyard and gets drunk and exposes himself. The very first thing that it says he does after he has this extraordinary moment of covenant with God. And then I've mentioned David, and we have a picture here of Bathsheba. It's a stunning, stunning phrase. So every year he goes to war. He's designed to be a warrior, a king, a leader. And every year he's designed to go to war, and he's been in persecution for 13 years after the previous king Saul. Saul then dies, he becomes king. And at some stage he starts to get complacent, and it says, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab, who is his commander, out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. But David remained in Jerusalem. And one evening he got up from his bed, walked around the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and that woman was very beautiful. That woman turns out to be Bathsheba, with whom he commits adultery. He lies to cover it up. He has her husband killed. And the fracture and the kind of disunity that comes in through his family, the sword that comes through his family as a result of that, just went on and on and on. Just desperately a painful, painful insight into the complacency that can set in, even in the most godly and incredible king that Israel has ever known, David. Really, he was him, and then it reflected a bit in Solomon, but he was really the height of a Davidic, a messianic king, and he got complacent. He should have been going to war, and he wasn't going to war, and actually he was taken out. Then we see Elijah, very different issue. He had this incredible showdown with the major opposing idols and demonic forces in the land. Amazing demonstration of the power of God over the prophets of Baal at the time. He defeats them. God is shown to be God. Ahab the king tells the queen Jezebel, and as soon as he hears Jezebel's been told, who was the sort of leader of all these prophets and the one who influenced them and brought them into the land, it says Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. So he has had this incredible showdown. He was on his own, there were hundreds of prophets, and he revealed that God was the God, the living God. And yet fear gripped him and he ran for his life. And that really was the beginning of the end of his ministry, that moment. And then we see Paul here. Almost tying back in the issue, the image of the laurel wreath, of the strict training, of the overcoming required, like we looked at last week. But actually what he does is he talks about how he has to be with himself after he's preached. Because when he preaches, he sees people come to the Lord, he sees people healed, he sees change, he takes territory. And then he gives a very interesting insight into his own spiritual discipline at that point, at his greatest weakness and vulnerability. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. It's an incredible statement that suggests that even someone who was walking and has that much power and authority, he was planting churches, he was seeing people, extraordinary healings. And he could be disqualified because of how he dealt with his vulnerability or weakness after preaching. And it's what's fantastically encouraging about Paul as he came through. We know that because in his very last letter to Timothy, he's in a dungeon. He says, I've run the race, I've kept the faith. And I'm going to get that prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ. It's one of my favourite verses in the Bible. He finished really well. And he says to us, New Covenant people, you can finish well too. You can come through. It's exactly the thrust of the end of these Revelation letters. Is we are overcomers. We're designed to overcome. And we will overcome even that complacency that can wait at the door, crouch at the door to rob us when we have had our breakthroughs. So what I love about these letters and about what we're learning about Jesus is there's an invitation here to see things the way he sees things. When people appear strong, to ask him actually what's really going on. And even when things or people or communities appear to be weak, to say what's really going on, to start to see the way he sees and come into agreement with his way of thinking and his way of seeing. But also for ourselves to define ourselves as overcomers, and when we've overcome, to acknowledge that that is a moment that we can never ever coast or rest on our laurels or let our guard down, but we continue to press in to that intimacy and connectedness with him that he has paid a price for us to get. And I think going back, we had this discussion just now, how do we buy gold refined in the fire? I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire. I think it just means we're designed to pay a price. I think buying involves paying a price. And you know when you're saying, I'm here at this moment, or I'm doing this, or I'm saying to this person, I feel the price. I know I'm paying a price to be here or to say this or to do that. And I think when we do that, then we're contending. That's the overcoming posture that we can always have. And that, as Hannah said as well, is available to any of us who want it. We can pay a price, and we can and receive that faith, which is like gold refined in the fire. We can become rich. We can be completely covered in purity and victory, and we can see clearly. So that is the end of looking at Revelation 3 and those first seven letters.